We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present, unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. For mankind's future on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio. It is Sunday night, June 28, 2015, here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. We are live every single Sunday night, midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific, and we got quite a show for you here today. We're going to be joined in about a half an hour by a very special guest here today. I was reading, I believe, The Anomalist, as always, and I saw a link to something called the Bluff Creek Project. And I looked around on the website, found some contact information. The next thing you know, I'm hooked up with Stephen Streufert, who's going to be our guest tonight. He's one of the individuals involved with the Bluff Creek Project. Now, what is the Bluff Creek Project? Well, you've probably heard of the world-famous Patterson-Gimlin film from 1968. Seen it on a million paranormal television shows. The legendary film of a supposed Sasquatch walking across the screen, turning to look at the camera, and continuing on its way. That is the Patterson-Gimlin film. It was filmed in a place called Bluff Creek, California. And the people involved with the Bluff Creek Project have found the original film site. Now, as you'll hear when I'm doing the interview with Stephen, so much about this I just found surprising. I wouldn't say baffling. I was surprised. I never really thought about the idea of the Bluff Creek filming location. I guess I had just taken it for granted that everybody knew where it was. And as Stephen will explain, what happened was everybody knew where the film site was for many years after the film was taken in 1968. And then, as time passed, as he will explain, the location of the Bluff Creek Patterson-Gimlin film became lost to time. And by the early 2000s, even the most hardcore Bigfoot researchers really didn't know where the original film site was. Now, this obviously is important because if you've ever watched Finding Bigfoot, for example, one of the things they do when there is a witness report is they go out there and they attempt to do a recreation. If there's a witness report or a film or something like that, sometimes they'll try and recreate the film. And obviously, if you believe that whatever happened at Bluff Creek, actually, it doesn't matter what you believe, whether you believe it was real or whether you believe it was a hoax, one thing that would be very helpful is if you could go to Bluff Creek, get some dude in a suit, and recreate the footage, put the camera in the same place, essentially, put the guy in the same place, and try and do some matchups. Is the guy the same size? Is he bigger? Is he smaller? I guess I just kind of took it for granted that this had been done, and there have been recreations. However, it wasn't until just a couple of years ago that the Bluff Creek Patterson-Gimlin film site was rediscovered. And Stephen is one of several individuals that is involved with this Bluff Creek project, which you can find more information about if you go to bluffcreekproject.blogspot.com. And what they've done is they've set up all sorts of trail cams, and they're doing all sorts of investigations, and they're trying to find out if they can discover any evidence of Sasquatch. Now, one of the main questions a person would ask is, have they done the recreation yet? Well, you're going to find out later tonight when we interview Stephen Stroyfert of the Bluff Creek Project. Stephen also works at a place called Bigfoot Books, which is a bookstore near Bluff Creek. And it is, in fact, a used bookstore. They sell books about everything. But there's obviously a lot of Bigfoot books there, so we can talk about that. Plus, his thoughts overall on this entire phenomenon. Is he a believer? Is he not a believer? What is the point of the Bluff Creek Project? What have they discovered? What are they trying to do? How are they raising money? We're going to talk about all of that tonight here on the program. And this man knows a lot about Bigfoot, obviously. As the man behind Bigfoot Books, you can imagine how many people come in and tell him their stories of Bigfoot, ask him questions about Bigfoot, sightings, reports, the whole nine yards. It is a really, really fun interview coming up later tonight with Stephen Stroyfert. As always here on this program, we've got a lot of news. We're also going to be opening up the phone lines both before and after the interview with Stephen Stroyfert, as we always do here on this program. And I would like to quickly direct everybody to AfterDarkRadioShow.com. That's the place to go for all of the information you need to contact this show. Every single one of our numbers are up there. We have four numbers as an homage to Art Bell, who I'll be talking about here in a moment. I'm going to read off the four numbers here very quickly. And at any point during this program, you can go up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com, and they are all there on the front page of the website, so I do not have to rattle them off throughout the show. But quickly, if you are west of the Rockies, the phone number, 425-488-0525. If you are east of the Rockies, 425-482-1686. We have a parts unknown line. You can call from anywhere in the world, anywhere in the universe, 425-398-7353. If you are a first-time caller, you have never called the After Dark Radio Show in your life, 425-398-7289. All of these numbers are available at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. You can also find my email, Brian@AfterDarkRadioShow.com. My Twitter handle, @BrianAlvarez. I will be monitoring Twitter throughout the show as everybody tweets with their thoughts on whatever we're discussing here on the program. And Facebook is facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. We got a lot of great stuff up on the Facebook page. My buddy Andrew, if you follow us on Facebook, you will not be bombarded with Facebook updates. He usually posts about 3 updates a day, and all of those updates end up on your news feed if you follow the After Dark Radio Show Facebook page. And there's a lot of great stuff up there. And Andrew is also the man. If you message the page, you can contact him about being a guest on this program, or if you've got a guest request, you can do that through the Facebook page as well. I would also like to mention, if you go to AfterDarkRadioShow.com, there is a link to last week's program. Our Sunday night debut was last week, and it was a big one. We were joined by Joshua Cutchin. He is the author of A Trojan Feast, which is an excellent book. It ties in stories of the giving and taking of food by aliens and fairies and even Sasquatch. It was a great interview last week with Joshua Cutchin. That entire show is available right now as a free download at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. It's only going to be up there until the end of the program, so I suggest going up there right now and downloading it. Listen to it later on. When this show ends, this program will be up there on the front page as a free download. So spread the word to all your friends about the After Dark Radio Show and the Dark Matter Radio Network. I'd also like to add, before we go to the phones here, and the phone lines are open if you'd like to get calling, if you head up to ArtBell.com, there is, of course, the countdown clock to the return of Art Bell, 21 days away. 21 days, 23 hours, 48 minutes, and 56 seconds. Art will be airing Monday through Friday, absolutely free, if you're listening live, on the Dark Matter Radio Network, which, of course, you're listening to right now if you're hearing the show, unless you're listening to a replay. But the Dark Matter Radio Network is available on TuneIn Radio. It is absolutely free. There will be no charge to listen live to Art Bell Monday through Friday. However, you have to become a time traveler in order to get the replay downloadable episodes if you cannot listen live. It is only $5 per month. All the information on how to become a time traveler is available at artbell.com. I know they've gotten tons of signups over the last couple of weeks. If you sign up today, you're essentially getting 2 months for, well, they're prorating it essentially. So you're not paying for something you're not getting. Essentially, the full month beginning on July 20th, plus all of the days until today, you're still only paying $5. So head up there and sign up. Once your 30 days of Art Bell are over, you will be renewed at $5 per month. It is a great deal, and all the information on how to grab that is up there at artbell.com. Once again, phone lines are open, and we are going to head to the East of the Rockies line. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland.
Yes, Ryan.
My question was, did you watch those videos last week? Because I feel sort of bad if you did.
The videos.
The Brian Ladd ones that were like 8 hours long.
Oh, I assure you I did not watch all 8 hours of those videos. In fact, I didn't watch 8 seconds of them. I did not.
Because Mike said something on the radio that you were ill, and I was afraid that maybe that was a side effect from watching one of those videos.
So you thought that maybe I'd watch the videos, I'd gotten violently ill and was forced to not do Wrestling Observer Live for 3 straight days.
That's the impression I got.
Well, I can assure you, Ryan, that was not the case. I, in fact, was not ill at all. He was working you.
Oh, okay.
Anything else on your mind?
Yes. There's something disturbing going on Twitter right now. Someone has created a Ryan from Cumberland page that isn't me. I don't know if this is one of these Doppelgangers that David was talking about, or if it's just a prank, or...
A Doppelganger?
Whatever David from Baltimore said they're calling, that they try to steal your identity.
So you think a Doppelganger might have created a fake Twitter account in your name?
Well, I can send you the link and maybe you'll know what's going on, but somehow they have it set up that it looks like they've been on for like 5 or 6 years, but I don't know if that's the case or not.
Oh, man.
It's Cumberland, Maryland.
Ryan.
Kind of weird because Cumberland's pretty small.
It's kind of worrisome that you may have a doppelganger.
Oh.
Well, send me the link and I'll do what I can. We may have David on the line. I want to thank you very much for the call. If this is David, maybe he can answer your question about a potential Twitter doppelganger. Let's go to the Parts Unknown line. You're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hello, Ryan. This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland.
Oh, yes. Jason from British Columbia. How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Brian?
Very well. The question
Brian,
is, how are you doing with Doom coming?
Well, Doom is coming, but, you know, it's not coming as soon as I think. Unless, you know, July 4th is this Saturday, Brian. It could happen then.
So wait a second. You're saying it's not coming as soon as you think?
Well, I don't know. I was thinking it was coming sooner than this, Brian, and I'm leaving the country tomorrow. So if it happens tomorrow, or it happens on Saturday, I won't be here to know about it.
So you are, of course, for those of you that have been listening for a while, predicting a horrible, devastating EMP attack. Is that correct?
Yes, Brian. You know, so an EMP attack would, you know, destroy the country. 3/4 of the population would die. No power, no working vehicles, and you know, people would die of starvation and murder and things like that. Because your neighbors will turn on you, Brian.
But hold on, you mentioned you're leaving the country, and so you may be all right. Are you saying this is an EMP attack directed strictly at the United States? What happens if I go to Vancouver, right over the border? Am I okay?
Well, I'm guessing all of North America will be affected. And the areas that aren't will be overrun by people, you know, fleeing there. And so those areas will be very unsafe also.
That's no good. That's no good. Where are you heading, Jason?
I'm heading to Portugal, Brian. A few years ago I was there, and I saw what I believe to be a giant fish. And so I'm going back, Brian, and I've chartered this boat. And I just wanted to let you know that there's a giant fish in Portugal, and I'm going to go find it. And, you know, if I never call the show again and I never post on the message board again on your website, the giant fish has gotten me, Brian.
Now, God forbid you don't return, but I need to know more about this giant fish. What exactly do you mean by a giant? Are we talking a whale? Are we talking a leviathan? What are we talking about?
Sort of more of a whale size, but I don't believe it was a whale, Brian. I believe it was a giant, maybe prehistoric fish. And I saw it once before, and I'm going back to look for it again, and I'm bringing, you know, things this time that I can capture pictures of it.
You sound like Captain Ahab here. You've seen this great fish once, and now you're obsessed with it.
Well, I've had dreams of it ever since, Brian, and you know there's a giant fish out there, but I'm going to get it.
This did not end well for Ahab.
Well, I don't plan to try and kill it. I plan to try and be the fish's friend.
I see.
I want to be there with its publicist, if one might
Was
say.
It white?
No.
What color was it?
It was, you know, fish color, you know, bluish green.
How big is big?
I would say, they say, you know, your memory is not very good. I would think it was 30 feet long, but maybe, you know, I might be exaggerating, so maybe 20.
20 feet long.
And just massive, you know, just a beast of a fish.
Were you with other individuals when you saw this giant fish?
Yes, I was, and two other people saw it, and they're both coming on the expedition.
Oh, really? So you've got a crew that you're taking with you to find this giant fish in Portugal?
We've chartered, you know, a substantial boat because I don't want to, you know, be murdered by this fish on the water.
Have you ever tried to Google giant fish Portugal and see if anything comes up?
Yes, nothing comes up that is, you know, like what I've seen.
I'm Googling it right now, actually.
So I'm going to break new ground, Brian. The world will never be the same.
Okay, well, the first thing that came up here was Portuguese man-o-war, which is an animal that has venomous tentacles which can deliver a painful sting.
Yeah, that's not this, Brian. This is a fish.
Well, my point is, stay away from that.
Well, I'll stay away from it, Brian. I'll have a nice cigar, and I'll toast to you while fishing for this fish. And hopefully we'll have an update for you soon.
Well, Jason, I want to thank you very much for the call and wish you the best of luck in searching for this giant Portuguese fish. And maybe you can send me some email updates or perhaps post on the board anywhere where you find internet. And hey, you called on the Parts Unknown line, which was coincidental, I'm sure. You can call from anywhere in the world. So I'm sure if you're in Portugal, you can call that number as well. So best of luck on your expedition. To the east of the Rockies line, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is David from Baltimore, Maryland.
Hello, David.
Hi, it's always a pleasure to call in, Brian. I'd just like to begin by addressing what Ryan from Cumberland was talking about with electronic doppelgangers.
Thank God you're doing this because I was very concerned for Ryan's health and well-being. He's got a Twitter doppelganger.
Yeah, I think he's a victim of more terrestrial identity theft, perhaps, or maybe somebody made a parody account of his.
So you're telling me you think it's more likely this is a parody account than an attack by a doppelganger?
If we were dealing with night hags or something that attempts to lure people to certain areas, I would agree with you that perhaps this is a supernatural situation. However, it's Mike from Cumberland.
It's Ryan. Unless, Ryan, but
sorry, Ryan from Cumberland. Unless he starts, the doppelganger starts professing a love of Brian Ladd, I don't think that it's 100% a doppelganger.
Hmm. Well, on another topic, tell me about your trail cams.
Oh, my goodness. So the East Coast has been absolutely pounded with a deluge of water falling from the sky for the past 48 hours. So my trail camera right now is underwater. So I don't have any
pictures.
It's
underwater?
For you, unfortunately. Yeah,
aren't you supposed to... Hold on a second. Aren't you supposed to put the trail cam like on a tree or something like that? Why is it so close to the ground that it's covered in water?
I sent you a picture. It's like 4 or 5 feet above the ground. I was thinking right around like deer height so I could get a nice picture of this albino deer. And if you look at the picture I sent you, it's completely flooded. So we're actually getting some new equipment, hopefully by next week, a GoPro. And I'm going to be taking that to some of the weird abandoned sewers that are about 5 or 10 minutes away from my house. So hopefully I'll be able to find something creepy and crawly for you there.
All right, I'm retweeting this right now. There is, in fact, a photograph of a swamp, and there is a trail cam one, it says, with a crudely drawn, I might add, arrow pointing to the water. So your trail cam is under there. That's no good.
No, not good at all. Hopefully the waterproofing retains, you know, the information in there. It would be cool if I actually could salvage some photos of that.
Oh, hey, listen. If it's underwater right there, maybe you can discover that giant fish that Jason is looking for.
You know what's funny? I actually heard a story in Lake Roland, which is close to where I am, about a giant catfish that was the source of some missing persons throughout the years. So stranger things have happened, Brian.
People were eaten by a giant catfish.
Swallowed whole, dude.
Wow.
That or like some of these catfish can get to be so large.
Swallowed whole?
Yeah.
Wait a second. How did we know that somebody was eaten by a giant catfish if they were swallowed whole and there was no evidence left?
Oh, I don't know. They find the catfish when they drain the lake and do an autopsy, and bada boom, like shoes and sneakers and dissolved body parts.
I see.
Yeah, but it's far more likely that when these giant fish open their mouth, they're creating a pressure differential underwater that makes it incredibly hard to swim, so you end up kind of drowning, almost like a rip current.
I see. Now, before you go here, why don't you tell everybody what you're looking for with this trail cam?
So right now, the trail camera that's currently underwater was set up about a week ago in hopes of seeing an albino deer. There's actually been some reports in my area, and I just thought it would be a cool thing to see. Not to mention, there are so many like deer in my area due to population density and where they've been like excavating and developing. So this genetic anomaly isn't super duper uncommon, considering the fact that there's such a large amount of viable breeding deer.
How about that? Well, I guess best of luck on your trail cam, your attempts to get a waterproof proof trail cam that you can put higher in a tree, and I hope you find this albino deer.
Yep. If not, I should have a GoPro, and I can start filming some more hands-on expeditions for you. Okay?
All right. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for the call. David is one of our weekly correspondents. He's always out looking for sometimes the wrong things. Doppelgangers, which have now attacked poor Ryan from Cumberland. Got some Twitter notes right here. This person believes, this is pseudo name, he believes that the giant fish is likely a whale shark. He says to Google it. All right, let's see what a whale shark looks like. I would presume it doesn't look good. Yep, that thing's pretty scary. 12.65 meters, that's about the size that he said. 21.5 metric tons, I presume he didn't weigh it when he saw it, but very well could be a whale shark. And this person says, big fish, Portugal, it is probably an ocean sunfish. And here is a picture of this heaviest known bony fish in the world, an average weight of 2,200 pounds, native to tropical and temperate waters around the globe. That thing's big. Hopefully Jason in BC is listening and he can check this out and maybe save himself on a trip back to Portugal with his team. Let's go to the east of the Rockies line. You're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
It's Ed in San Antonio.
Yes, Ed.
Yeah, I want to call and tell you about this story about this nightclub that I worked at. I bartended when I was about 20 years old.
Hold on a second. You were bartending at 20?
I was bartending at 19, actually.
That doesn't sound legal.
No, it's fine. You can serve alcohol. You just can't drink it.
Okay.
But I was licensed and everything, so, I mean, it was cool. But this little bar, it was a little Tejano nightclub, and it was just a few blocks from my house. And it was owned by the dad of my brother's childhood best friend. And I only worked there for a couple months because I didn't make no money and I was being threatened to be shot like every night. So I got out of there. But this nightclub, every couple of years, it would change the name, and then they'd go on and change the name and so on. And all of a sudden, one time, it just died. It just kind of went out of business. Nobody went there anymore. And come to find out, what happened is, like, I saw a for sale sign, and I mentioned to my brother, I go, hey, Albert's dad is selling the old nightclub. And he told me the story that I hadn't heard until just the other day. And basically what happened was, is there, you know, it's packed one night, everyone's having a good time, and there's some girl who's drunk, and she's dancing with some guy, and all of a sudden, the lower half of this guy was an animal, like a, I don't know, like a deer or something. And everybody saw that, was in the club, saw this, they stampeded out of the club, and no one ever went back after this. It's the weirdest thing. I had no idea. I worked there. I had no idea until my brother just told me. But, yeah, it was like supposedly the devil. People tell stories about the devil being seen here, and it's always, like, from the waist down, he's, like, has, like, hoofs, and, like, he's, like, half horse or deer or something like that. But I just thought that was a kind of funny story from a place I used to work at.
Funny, Ed says. The devil showed up and transformed in front of everybody. It's funny. So yeah, the bottom half of his body just transformed into a whatever?
Yeah, like he had hooves. I know he had hooves, but like it was something like a horse or a deer. You'll hear like a lot of stories in South Texas about people seeing like the devil. And part of the description is he has, from the waist down, he has like animal legs and hooves. So that's why everyone's got scared, because they saw that and they assumed he was the devil and they just ran.
Could you go back to that bar right now?
It's closed. It's been closed for years. That was pretty much the end of it.
The devil shut the bar down?
The devil shut the bar down. They never got people to go back after that.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's how like the word spread, because it was like on the south side. It was a Tejano nightclub. It was even a nice class Tejano nightclub. It was kind of like a lower class. And it would do business, but then that happened, and that was it. That was it for this club.
How about that? And was it your brother, you said?
Yeah, he's the one that told me the story.
But he wasn't there.
No, he wasn't there, but like I say, the guy who owned the bar is my brother's, like, childhood best friend.
I think you need to interview this guy.
I'll try and get him on. I'll see if I can talk to him. He still lives down the street from me, I think.
All right, I'm going to put you on this, Ed, and I want you to try and get a hold of this guy, and I want to have him on the show. Was he himself a witness?
When I worked there, he was always there, so I can find out. I'll try and find out and let you know.
All right.
If not, I can maybe see if my brother knows more details, maybe get him on there, but he's not as entertaining as I am.
Few are, Ed, I'm sure. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for the call, and yes, I want you to put you, I want to task you that a job of finding out if he actually saw the devil. Because if he did, I need to have him on the show. I don't think I've ever interviewed anyone who's seen the devil. So that would be a first here on this program. All right, everybody, we're going to get ready for this interview here. As noted, we are going to be joined momentarily by Stephen Stroyfert. He is one of the individuals involved in the Bluff Creek Project, information of which you can find at bluffcreekproject.blogspot.com. There's a lot of great stuff up there, including some videos. We'll talk about the videos here on the program in just a moment. You can find out how you can sponsor a camera. They're always in need of cameras and camera batteries and all sorts of different things. So information on that is up at the website as well. There is a link to the Facebook page and so much more. So once again, that is Bluff Creek Project at blogspot.com. And in just a moment, we are going to head to a break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Stephen Stroyfert. We got a lot of things to talk about. The original site of the Patterson-Gimlin film has been rediscovered, and they are there every night. Not every night, but they've got trail cams there every night, nonstop throughout the year. And we're going to talk to Stephen Stroyfert about what they've discovered. So we'll be back in just a moment with that. You're listening to After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Very happy today to be joined by Stephen Stroyfert. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about, including the Bluff Creek Project. And Stephen, how are you doing today?
Oh, fine, thank you.
I know that you are in the bookstore as we speak, and it is very, very, very hot outside. It's only like 92 here, so I thought I was hot until I heard how hot it was there.
Yeah, it was 109 when I got in my car up in the parking lot. Too hot even for Bigfoot, I think.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Well, let's
it'd be a lot nicer to be up in Bluff Creek right now in the shady creek surrounded by trees.
That's right. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the bookstore here very quickly, and then we'll get into the Bluff Creek Project.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit about it.
Oh, well, it's a used bookstore with a whole building full of books in all categories. You know, a lot of people think that I'm selling only Bigfoot books because the name of the store is Bigfoot Books. But here in Willow Creek, almost everything is Bigfoot, like the Bigfoot Burger, you know, the Bigfoot Restaurant. There's even a Bigfoot Podiatry in the phone book. So we just call everything after Bigfoot here. I've got romance novels and history and all that other stuff, too.
Romance novels, I presume, not about Bigfoot.
No, that is a big genre these days, the cryptid erotica.
Yes.
Number one seller on Amazon, actually. Yeah, outdoing almost all of the nonfiction books about Bigfoot.
Now, when you say cryptids, I mean, I'm well aware there's obviously the vampire genre and that sort of thing, but... when you hear cryptids, I mean, you start to think about hairy animals. I mean, what are we talking about here?
Just about any creature could be called a cryptid. I mean, technically, cryptozoology is the study of what they call hidden animals, which are proposed to exist, but have not yet been proven to exist. A lot of them, of course, are not existing at all. They're just myths or legends. They're, you know, the whole thing, crypto-terrestrials and the inhumanoids, and it kind of expands to include spirit beings and aliens and all of that. If you take it a little farther, right?
Let me ask you this question, because you run this used bookstore here, and obviously all sorts of different kinds of books come in, and I'm sure you're well aware of what's going on. So when I was a kid, I'm 40 now. When I was a kid, there were obviously people that read comic books, but they were kind of considered geeks. And now it's like a big thing. I mean, it's cool to be a geek now. When I was a kid, it was not cool to be a geek. Now it's cool to be a geek when you're younger. And all of these people are reading comic books are huge today. But what is it with the crypto erotica? Like, is there, I mean, going kind of deeper into it, I mean... Do you have any sort of theories about what is it about the world? What is it about people's relationships? What is it about comics? Do you have any theories about why crypto erotica now is all of a sudden something that's popular?
Well, to address what you were first saying, about the, what was it you were saying?
The comics.
The comics. You know, we're all geeks nowadays. You know, the internet has kind of made us all nerds. To, you know, distinguish yourself, you have to find a real niche area of interest, and it gets more and more and more refined, so you can't even keep track of the genres of these things anymore. Like, you know, there's not just heavy metal, there's like 50 or 100 different subgenres of heavy metal.
Sure.
So, you know, the business of crypto erotica, I mean, that goes back into the kind of archetypal basis for the wild man, you know, what it symbolizes to our species, going back, you know, into the earliest written texts, you know, in Gilgamesh and the Bible and so forth. We have wild, hairy humanoids, you know, and, you know, the truth is right there in the Bible, you have a hairy humanoids, you know, who are meeting with other humans, you know, so
yeah.
The Bigfoot thing, you know, by the time it emerges here in the United States, we have the Native Americans who have a longstanding tradition of this thing. And, they are also the ones who talk about Bigfoot abducting, people, especially, women,
for a mate, or, you know, children, they'll eat the children. This might have just been a boogeyman tale that was told by people around the campfire, but, you know, it does emerge in pop culture. When we get to the recent days, like the legend of Boggy Creek in the 70s, you know, he's a lonely, alienated being living on the outskirts of human society. He's the last of his kind, and he's, you know, creeping around in the dark, staring through windows at co-eds and so forth. So, you know, this is an archetype, I guess. These modern things, I don't know if they're meant to be funny or what, but there's a huge interest for them, and I can't really understand it beyond humor, because I don't know how anyone can get excited by the thought of such things.
I don't know.
Yeah, some of it's pretty bad. I haven't really read all of these books, but you can go on Amazon and look at all the very creative titles.
I can only imagine. I'm actually not going to go up right now, because it'll just throw this show completely off.
I don't think I can mention them on the air, but some of them are pretty bad, or good, depending on how you view it.
Sure. You know, I had a guest on last week, Joshua Cutchin, who has written a book called A Trojan Feast. And he's tied in reports of aliens and UFOs to fairies. And he mentioned Sasquatch as well, because the whole book is really about how, whether you believe that you ran into fairies and elves and were taken to fairyland, or whether you believe you were abducted by aliens, or even whether you believe that you were kidnapped by Bigfoot, there is often the theme of the giving and taking of food. And so he had the tie in there. But one thing that he did mention was just what you were talking about. There are so many Bigfoot reports, less nowadays, but there have been in the past, Native Americans and Albert Ostman and others, where they were kidnapped by Bigfoot for whatever reason. And sometimes the Bigfoot, as you noted, is interested in a mate if it's a female. And there are stories about Bigfoot eating children. And I guess my question to you is, what do you think about these stories? As somebody who is a Bigfoot researcher, I mean, it seems to me that we hear a lot less in the 21st century of Bigfoot abducting people, but certainly there were stories in the past. Do you think a lot of these were just stories told around the campfire to scare the Native American children? Or do you think maybe there really was something to Bigfoot kidnapping humans?
Well, you know, it could be both.
Yeah.
These kind of scary stories get more scary the closer they get to ordinary human life, you know. The scariest monsters are the ones that are most human. They're the creepiest to us, and I'm sure that these kind of things crop up just naturally in campfire stories, but that doesn't mean that they couldn't be based upon something. You know, a lot of mythology is based on something, you know, like we have the idea of dragons, but it probably came out of them finding dinosaur bones. So, I mean, there could be a Bigfoot abducting people. I know there are still Native women who are afraid to go out in the woods alone. They've told me this out here, you know, in our area. But, yeah, I mean, it's got to have a lot of exaggeration. Bigfoot researchers these days are generally looking for an animal or some kind of proto-human rather than a mysterious monster or a mystical being. You know, we like to think that if it's real, it's not a shape-shifting spirit from another dimension, but, you know, it's an animal. Most of the reports you get tend to describe something that's living like an ordinary creature. You know, it leaves footprints and it eats things and leaves scat piles and beds and so forth. You know, it's leaving an impact on the earth. So that's the proposition going today by most of the mainstream Bigfoot people, that it's a living animal, you know, but the Native people generally didn't view it that way. It was more of a spirit, not necessarily in the form of a Bigfoot. Around here, a lot of the people, the Native folks, believe that it was capable of taking whatever form it wanted. You know, it was basically a guardian spirit of the mountains.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I have always thought if Bigfoot exists, it's got to be a flesh and blood creature. But in the book that I was reading last week, Joshua Cutchin's book, I mean, he makes the exact same point. I mean, to a lot of Native Americans and others who have reported this, it was, I don't want to say it wasn't an animal, but it had supernatural, there were aspects of it that were supernatural. And I think it's interesting because nowadays, most researchers completely discount that. And that's kind of, I mean, if you talk to, have you, I'll ask this question. Have you spoken to Native Americans recently? And what do they think today about the idea that Bigfoot is a flesh and blood creature? Do they still try to claim that they also believe there's some supernatural aspect to it?
Well, we have several tribal groups right around us here, you know, in Willow Creek. We have the Yurok and the Hoopa and the Karuk just in our mountain area, not counting the coastal tribal groups. And they all have different opinions. You know, they're modern people as well as the people who come from a traditional culture. So some of them don't believe in Bigfoot at all, you know. It's definitely not required to be a Native person that you believe in the old myths or legends, you know. But if you look at Native view of reality, it's not the same as the European objective, rationalist, scientific worldview. You know, they might have had spiritual or mystical ideas about Bigfoot, but they also have the same ideas about coyotes and crows.
That's true.
And mountains and trees, so all these things have a spirit, including humans. We ourselves are spiritual entities, you know, in that culture. So it's a different worldview. Worldviews can look at the same thing and not see it in the same way. So that they'll tell you, depending on whom you speak with, you know. Some of them say it's just an ape. It's just an animal. And they see it, and it comes through their yard seasonally, and these footprint tracks behind. Others will claim, you know, it's the mystical thing. And others, you know, think it's a kind of a human. But this really depends person to person, you know, in the Native culture these days.
Now, when you mention the area that you are at, Bigfoot books, obviously, I live up here in Seattle, and we've got a fair amount of Bigfoot stuff up here. There's a Bigfoot car wash, obviously, and that sort of deal. In fact, there's a road that I drive on when I head to my wife's parents' house, and there's a Bigfoot crossing sign on the side of the road. So it's around here, but it sounds to me like where you're at is how Roswell is. This whole mythology, I mean, it's just everywhere. You are surrounded by Bigfoot. Would you say that most of the people, let's just take an average month in the bookstore, and you've got X number of people coming in. Do the vast majority of people believe in Bigfoot? Or is it kind of like a fun thing, and they enjoy the local flavor, but they don't really believe there's a monstrous ape in the woods?
Well, yeah. When I first opened the store in 2005, most of the people I got were locals who might want to book, you know. But the ones who talked about Bigfoot, they generally would tell me stories of, you know, having seen one, or their uncle or grandpa or some relative might have seen one. But you know, the people that came in back in those days were the serious Bigfoot people. Who are interested in the research, you know, coming up here. Bluff Creek is just 30 miles north of my store here. And this is known as the Bigfoot capital of the world, basically because this is where all the workers were who found those tracks back in 1958 and, you know, started the Bigfoot legend as a popular theme. But nowadays, since the Finding Bigfoot and all these crazy TV shows everywhere about Bigfoot, including Survivor Man, I get a lot of people coming from all around the world. It's kind of disheartening because the book business is in decline with everybody reading Kindles and everything. less and less people want to buy all the other books in the store. I might have like 60,000 of them in here. And I can see by the look on their face when they walk in the door what who is a Bigfoot person. And they immediately walk over to the three shelves that I have of about 120 titles on Bigfoot. And those are the books they always want and the ones that they always want to talk about. It just never stops. It's Bigfoot all day long for me in this place. And, you know, I can't even just go down to the grocery store without seeing Bigfoot at least three or four times. With the statues all along the highway. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. You mentioned finding Bigfoot and Survivor Man. I've always enjoyed finding Bigfoot as a television show, but they never find anything. There's very little in the way of anything that compels me to think that they are on the trail of anything. I like the show. I would love to interview anybody involved in the show, and it is a television show, so God only knows what really happens, what doesn't happen, what's there strictly to entertain a television audience. But Survivor Man, I haven't seen a lot of episodes, but I've had people say that one actually is a pretty good show. I guess what are your thoughts on Survivor Man and Finding Bigfoot?
Yeah, well, Survivor Man, maybe he's acting and hamming it up. He's, you know, trying all these different techniques and ideas and spending time with some somewhat dubious researchers. I think just for the variety, you know, to expose his viewership to all these different ideas of Bigfoot. So, I mean, I would suppose in his mind, he's exploring all the options, you know. So he goes out there and he'll provisionally kind of try these things. You can tell he doesn't necessarily believe in Bigfoot. He is experimenting and testing the hypothesis. And it's kind of what we do, you know, up in Bluff Creek. We have usually about 20 or so trail cameras strategically placed all around the biggest hotbed of Bigfoot activity in history. You know, we're testing the hypothesis. So far, after 3 years of doing this, we've had no Bigfoot cross the path of our cameras. And those are down in the, you know, the hot spots where the film site is, on the creek, the water, the game trails, and everything, the food sources are all there. So any living creature that's looking to survive out there is going to have to cross the path of our cameras. So, I mean, if that's the case, we have these running 24/7 all year round, including in the winter, you know, about 8 or 9 months of the year, depending on the weather. They actually have no people up there, and they lock the gates, you know. We only get to go in there from June until early October, usually. So you can't really blame Finding Bigfoot for not finding anything. Especially because they go out in the woods with a big production crew, you know,
sure.
filming themselves, but also they're being filmed and they're directing the behaviors. And a lot of that is how they do the research. I've been out in the woods with Bobo and Cliff, and they do that same kind of stuff. But, you know, you can never just expect results. If it were predictable, we'd already have captured a Bigfoot or bagged one for science, and we haven't been able to do that. So what they do get is sighting reports from the communities, and I think that's the thing that's most intriguing. Most days I'm kind of disinclined to believe in Bigfoot because the researchers have been trying for so long and failing so miserably. About all we really have is that Patterson film, and even that, as good as it is, it's not enough to prove the thing's real. But ongoing, you know, from a long, long time ago in the beginnings of time in the 1800s when it first started being documented, till today, there are people who see these things. So, I mean, the question for me that is most serious is why do people see them? And if they're not real, that's even a more serious question. Why are people seeing something that's not real in the form of a big, hairy man? That perhaps the easiest explanation for that is that they are real, but so far they've eluded the documentation, you know.
You sound very much like me. I I don't know if I would say I'm disinclined to believe in Bigfoot, but I have zero evidence that I cite as, okay, that's enough for me. I very much, if you've listened to one show, I'm sure you're well aware that I am very, very fascinated by the Patterson film. I don't care what anybody says. I don't think it looks like a man in a suit, but it is just a film. That's really all we have. So I guess we should start talking about the history of the Bluff Creek site. This is where the Patterson-Gimlin film was recorded nearly 50 years ago, actually. And I don't know why I never really thought about this, but I never really thought about if anybody knew where it was. And I don't know why I never thought of that. That should have been like my first question that I considered in my mind, but I don't know. I saw the video so many times, and it looks like it's such a wide open area that I guess I just presumed obviously everybody knows where it is. But I guess that really has not always been the case. Tell us the history of the Bluff Creek area, the area where this film was taken.
But I assume you mean like our project to find the film site?
Sure, yes.
After it got lost in the woods.
How did it get lost? Let's start with that. When the film was first taken, I mean, did Patterson and Gimlin like have a map of the area? I mean, take us through like the history from the very beginning. When did we know where it was, and when did we lose it, and how?
Sure, they had maps of the area. It was surveyed by then, and they were doing road building projects nearby, and they had found some tracks just earlier in August. So that's what brought them down here. These tracks and this film site are all in the general area in the center and upper area of Bluff Creek in the watershed there, where in 1958 they found those tracks along the road they were building then. So, you know, Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin came down here on the information that there were three Bigfoot walking around different size tracks that summer. So they expected to hopefully find more tracks. And Patterson was hoping to make some kind of a documentary or docudrama about Bigfoot. So he had a camera with him, and they were just filming scenery, not really finding anything. And they were going up and down this creek bed that had been scoured out pretty seriously by the massive 1964 flood. So you found a lot of big open sandbars where the flood had, you know, torn out all the trees and vegetation and left behind the silty sand. So, you know, they were out looking for tracks along there and doing that kind of thing. And that's when they filmed the creature, or, you know, if you believe it's a hoax, they did a hoax out there. But it was on a wide open sandbar that had been blasted open by that major flood. And, you know, during the early times of Bigfoot investigations, people could just walk up the creek and find it because it was obvious. It was wide open. But, you know, by the early 70s, you can already see trees and plants regrowing out of the sand. And by the 80s, it was getting pretty dense. So you could walk by the creek and not even see the big trees that were visible behind the film subject anymore. So by the time it got to be the 90s, when I was living here in Humboldt County, I just assumed too that it was somewhere out there in the mountains and people knew where it was. But I came out here to Willow Creek and I started realizing I don't even know where Bluff Creek is. I started trying to find where it was, and I realized when I moved to Willow Creek that it was only 29 miles north of town. So, you know, I went up there to look for the film site, and all I saw was dense forest everywhere up that creek. You know, it was all overgrown. It all kind of looked the same. And by the late 90s, you know, the mid-90s, late 90s, John Green and Bob Titmuss, two of the guys who had been on the film site and documented the tracks and recreated the film with an actor next to where the creature walked, they couldn't find the film site. You know, and at that point, I began to ask some serious questions. When I went to the International Bigfoot Symposium that was held here in 2003, none of these big name guys who went to that could find the film site and say, this is it for sure. And even Bob Gimlin was there, Bob Gimlin went and wandered right past it, and was everybody was basically lost by then. It was only towards the end of the afternoon that Bob Gimlin, having seen some of the canyon, said something to the regard of, well, I think this might be where we first saw her, you know. But even then, nobody could find the big trees. So, like, when you see Finding Bigfoot recreating the film site action, they're not really on the right spot, you know. They're near where the right spot for the first sighting was, but the recreation is done down in the creek, and that you can't even see those big trees and the stumps and things that you see in the film. So we started the film site project in 2009, and it took us basically three seasons, 2009, 10, and 11, to find and then document the film site. You know, and when we did discover the big tree in the back, we realized that we had walked right past that thing many times and just didn't notice that it was even the right tree. You know, and all the artifacts around there, the stumps and the other trees, they were all right in front of our noses, but we couldn't see the forest for the trees, as it were. You know, it was all hidden, and it was so dense that you could only see, you know, 10, 20 yards in front of you before it just turned into a dark thicket of overgrown branches. But we were able to find the film site, and we did a site survey, and we documented all the old artifacts that had been there before the thing had overgrown. And so then we were able to take those artifacts and compare them, you know, using mathematics to aerial photographs and other photographs of the film site. And then we were able to prove the location was indeed the right one. But basically, it was lost to the public and lost to the researchers as well. We never found anybody who could convincingly show us the film site. And I've heard legends of certain people who've been going there every year. But, of course, they're secret and they never talk. So they didn't do us any good. We had to disprove at least five different theories as to where the film site was by major researchers, and they were all wrong. You know, the mark was in a book on a map that had been marked by Rene de Hinden for Daniel Perez, one of these researchers. But even Daniel Perez, whose book it was, could not find the spot on the ground. So. Even the maps didn't necessarily help us.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things that I actually do like about Finding Bigfoot is when they do attempt to do a recreation of a film. And every show they'll do a recreation of some witness's testimony, like Bubba will say, "I'll go stand there, tell me when to stop raising my hand," and it's inevitably like 8.5 feet tall. And it's always sort of like, well, that doesn't tell me anything. I mean, that doesn't tell me anything. But every now and then they'll get a film, and they'll send Bobo out there, and they'll try to recreate the film to at least find out if whatever was on the film is bigger, smaller, about the same size as Bobo. And often it's the same size or smaller. Every now and then they find something that is questionable. But my first question would be, what are the best recreations of the Patterson-Gimlin film? And what can you deduce, if anything, from these recreations?
Well, there really aren't any decent recreations. You know, that's one of the biggest strong points of that film, is that the skeptics love to scoff at it. And there's even some special effects artists who like to scoff at it and say, "Oh, I could do that." But none of them have, you know, none of them have convincingly replicated that film. There are a few guys who made suits, but they generally look really bad.
They're terrible.
When they walk in them, they don't replicate the strange and mysterious gait and body movements of the creature. That creature in the film, you know, it looks odd. It looks a lot like a human, but it also moves strangely and differently. I think there's an enigmatic quality about it that just hasn't been replicated. even with the BBC, even the guy who claims to have made the suit for Roger Patterson, and the guy who claims to have worn the suit, Bob Hieronymus, wearing that suit, they couldn't recreate it convincingly at all. These things look terrible. You know, John Green was there in 1968 with Jim McLaren, and they could still see depressions in the ground where the creature walked. So they had him walk along, you know, the trackway. And, you know, they showed Jim McLaren was kind of like Bobo. He's 6'2" or 6'3", but he's a very skinny-looking guy, tall and lanky. So he's walking along the trackway, and John Green had his camera placed with comparative use of slides and such, very close to where Patterson had his camera. And, you know, Jim McLaren looks small. He looks almost as tall as the Bigfoot creature, but maybe half the width of the creature, you know, just nothing close. And, you know, I mean, I suspect if we put Bobo out there walking along, he would look smaller than the thing, too. But, you know, we haven't been able to prove that. And we can't really do a recreation on the film site. I mean, even though I know Bobo, I've been up there with him. We even had a camera like the one Patterson used, a 16-millimeter Kodak camera. We couldn't really recreate that film because there's still so many trees growing on the site, and just can't replicate it anymore.
That was actually kind of my question, because so there has been, I mean, obviously a tremendous amount of regrowth over the course of 50 years. I mean, that wide open area, from what you've been talking about here, is no longer wide open. You can't just go there, set up a camera, and have some dude in a suit try to recreate it. It's just not possible anymore.
Yeah. And part of the quality of the film is the setting. You know, the dynamics of him moving across the creek and running up the sandbar bank and getting up on the high raised flood-creating sandbar and then pursuing the creature. All of these things, you know, and the relationship to the background trees and the logs and stumps that you see in the film, they create the image of the Bigfoot. And they give the impression of its size as well. You know, so there's a lot of perspective illusions in that film. And it was one of the hard things about finding the film site was because we had so many misconceptions looking at a flat two-dimensional plane. You know, we didn't realize how big the space was behind the subject and so forth and so on. But, you know, it has overgrown completely. But the film site itself was preserved because it was on this raised sandbar. So as far as we've been able to determine, there was never a flood that again crested over the film site. And so what we have there is this sort of time capsule. We've lost maybe 20 feet to 20 yards, depending on how you look at it, of the front of the sandbar. But all of the film action that's actually recorded on camera, that ground is still there. And so are the old stumps. You know, they're sitting in the ground since they were cut in the mid-60s before the film. And they're still there, sitting big piles of stuff that's not been rotten away and it hasn't been washed away. You know, so we can determine something. We're hoping with the survey we're going to do with a professional surveyor this summer, we're hoping to determine perhaps finally, how tall and how wide that creature is. Maybe it's 7 feet tall and 4 feet wide. I don't know.
I think obviously that's a very important, I mean, to me, that's number one, is find out if it's possible that it could have been a man in a suit. And if the answer that you get is it appears impossible, to me, you still don't have proof that Bigfoot exists. But that's going to go a long way towards disproving people that just blindly throw out, it looks like a guy in a suit. I honest to God, I don't know what people are talking about when they say that, because as you mentioned, every single time I've seen a man in a Bigfoot suit, it totally looks like a man in a Bigfoot suit. And
yeah,
it just doesn't look like the Patterson-Gimlin film. These guys are out there in 1968. They've got this camera. I mean, it looks so... It just appears beyond their means. I mean, maybe they just deserve so much credit. They should have been multimillionaires in Hollywood, but I've never seen anyone do it right.
Yeah. I mean, if it was a hoax, it was incredibly well planned.
It'd be the greatest hoax of all time.
The suit would have had to be very good, and it has the shape of muscles. Some people claim to see the muscles moving, but, I mean, it's undeniable that you can see authentic back and leg and arm muscles on that thing. Maybe the ass of the thing doesn't look too realistic, but used to say what Bigfoot's rear end is supposed to look like.
Who knows?
You know, but the thing is, it's at just the right distance and resolution, so it seems very clear and impressive, but it's not clear enough and impressive enough to either reveal that it's truly a real animal or to reveal it, that it's a suit, you know?
You know,
when we film suits, we get up pretty close, and we have these modern-day cameras. We're recording them with good lighting, and, of course, all the flaws stand out. But, you know, in that environment, especially with the moving camera and the shifting perspective, there's a lot of potential illusions, just as we had illusions to deal with when we're trying to find the artifacts of the film site. There could be some qualities to the film that make the creature look bigger than it really is. Like the way it moves in between the log piles and the stumps and in relation to the trees in the background. We're talking about a couple hundred feet there. You know, it's not just like right behind the creature. You know, but it looks huge because of the perspective illusions. But, you know, trying to defeat that, we've done triangulation measurements with the stumps and the artifacts. And we know basically the walking area of that film subject down to within a foot or less. It's not precise enough, but just rough calculations that we've done, two different methods, one by one of our team, Jamie, and another by Bill Munns, who's a special effects film expert. Both of them came up with the same conclusion, that it was bigger than a man by substantial measures. You know, 7'1", 7'2", or maybe almost 4 feet wide. But, you know, there's a margin of error there, perhaps of 3 or 4 inches. So
sure.
You can turn 7'2" into 6'11" or 10 or whatever. You know?
And granted, I mean, my other job is it's pro wrestling. And so there are men who are 6'10", 6'11", 7 feet tall. But most of them are very lanky. There are some of them that are a little bit thicker. But still, we're talking, that is an extreme level of thickness. There aren't a lot of people like that in the entire world. And...
Sure.
You know, another thing, I read an article about this, and I'd always kind of, I never thought it looked like a man in a suit, but I once read an article that was talking about various men in suits in movies, and we're talking Hollywood budgets, we're talking movies with budgets like Star Wars and such, and one thing that they noted was, if you ever look at the hairy men in the movies, it doesn't matter who is in the suit, anybody from Andre the Giant to some skinny guy, the one thing you'll always see in these suits is that the body hair will be a certain length, but it will always have long hair around the neck because that's what covers up the fact that a guy is wearing a mask. You can't have a short-haired costume with a short-haired head because then you can see the big cutaway where the guy puts the head on. And it was noted that the Patterson-Gimlin film is like, that's the one hairy monster in a movie that has short hair all over the body. And you can't see the seam, you can't see a cut, you can't see anything. Every other one, the Grinch, Chewbacca, Harry and the Hendersons, they all have long hair around the neck because that's how you hide that you're putting a mask on a guy's head. I just was blown away by that.
Yeah, sure. And when the film subject turns its head to look back, it doesn't seem to crumple up like you'd expect.
No.
You know, turning a mask, looking a full, you know, sideways glance from the front to the side, you would expect to see some crumpling of mask material. And that's not really there. It looks very authentic, you know. There are people who claim there's seams visible, like on the arms and the hip area and stuff. But a lot of that, I think, is lighting problems. You know, there's various film versions, you know, where some of them are losing color. Some of them are washed out and overexposed. Some of them are too dense, dark. And so you can go from having the creature look like it's got dense fur on one version, and then, you know, you go to another, it's all gray, and it looks like balding along the sides, you know. But I have probably one of the best images that's out there right now. It was a scan taken from Patricia Patterson's own collection that was taken on a 3x5 transparency sheet off the original film. And this was done by M.K. Davis. And you can look at this thing and you can see the skin, actual skin on the breasts of this creature. It doesn't look like fur, you know. What you've got there, if this is the correct color and exposure of the image, you've got like a thin hair, you know, that reveals the body shape, you know, the shape of the breasts, which in a crappy fur suit would just be covered up, you know, by shag. And you know, same thing on the legs, you know, if you look at the calf and the thigh, they show muscles, shapes of muscles anyway. So, you know, the more you stare at this thing, the more you get this impression like, wow, you know, the leg shows muscles and they seem to change throughout the film. So that's muscle movement. I don't know how a suit could replicate that. It would be very hard to do.
Now, when we do look at this from a skeptical slant, one could point out that you, as part of the Bluff Creek project here, have gone to the actual site. You've put trail cams everywhere. They've been running nonstop pretty much for about 3 years now. And there's a video up here. You can see a highlight video. And I mean, there's mountain lions, there's bears, there's all sorts of animals that have been captured on these trail cams. No Bigfoot, nothing for years.
Nope. It's kind of shocking, isn't it?
I can imagine that might be a little frustrating.
Well, you know, we're not invested in believing in Bigfoot or not. Like, honestly, we get accused of that sometimes, trying to exploit Bigfoot so people will buy books in my store or something. It's just totally not true. We're very skeptical. And part of our doing this camera project is that skepticism. You know, we're honestly looking. And, so far, we have to sort of shrug our shoulders and say, you know, we haven't found sign of Bigfoot out there at all. We found a few tracks, but they could have been bear. You know, they could even have been human in the dirt coming down the hill. But, you know, other Bigfoot researchers look up there and they have an encounter every day. Any little sound in the woods becomes Bigfoot to them. So, I mean, I think we're the most skeptical, the most honest, and we would honestly love for Bigfoot to show up, you know. But, you know, we're trying to do science. Wildlife survey of wildlife out in the area. And I think we've shown pretty well the habitat and what kinds of animals live there and their lifestyles, you know, the deer and the mountain lions and the bear. We have ringtail cats and bobcat and squirrels and all the other kinds of creatures. So to that extent, I think we're successful. But obviously, it's not looking good for Bigfoot in the view that our project has presented so far. You know?
Now, you, we're going to talk about the Bluff Creek project here because you are attempting to raise a little bit more money. Obviously, you need camera batteries and that sort of thing. Trail cams so far haven't seen anything, but you mention somewhere on one of these various sites that, in fact, there have been, and this kind of, I don't even know how to ask this question. There have been a few cameras that have malfunctioned. There have been a few cameras where you expected something to be filmed and nothing was filmed. There have been cameras where weird things have occurred. And this is not an isolated incident. You can talk to all sorts of Bigfoot researchers, and they'll mention the same thing. Man, we thought we had something, but it didn't. The camera didn't work. It malfunctioned. It's exactly when people talk about UFO sightings. Man, it was right there, and the camera didn't work. It raises, obviously, a question that I think that a lot of Bigfoot researchers don't like asking, which goes all the way back to the supernatural aspect of it. People actually make jokes about it nowadays. The joke about, well, I've discovered that Bigfoot is actually, it's not an animal. It is a blurry, out-of-focus image. That's why when everyone takes photos, that's what they get. Bigfoot for real is blurry and out of focus. You start to get jokes like that, but is this coincidence? Has this happened to you guys elsewhere? How often do you hear these stories? What do you make of this strange phenomenon where the cameras just don't work?
I have to say, I think it's just a coincidence, you know, and a bunch of excuses. You know, electronics do malfunction, especially electronics left out in the elements, like we do. We leave the cameras out all winter, from fall till spring. So, I mean, granted, we're going to probably show up, and some of them have just failed. They're not perfect technology yet either, you know. So they just do wonky things. Something goes wrong with them, and it's hard to explain why. But I don't think there's any evidence that Bigfoot is causing these things to go wrong. Especially because, you know, of the two cameras we had fail on the film site this fall, winter period, they may have failed, but we had two others on the film site, one down in the creek that didn't fail. So if there were a Bigfoot around, you know, using his superpowers or his psychic zapping power, whatever these people claim, you know, to disable electronics, we would have gotten him on one of the other cameras, I think, you know, because they're all looking at each other's view sheds. So, you know, we have like a mountain lion's coming down the hill, walking past one camera, and then another camera down on the other side of the hillside catches them. So we have two different views of these subjects on our videos. Despite that, you know, it's really common in the Bigfoot community to, you know, make an excuse for why Bigfoot's never found, you know, and they don't want to consider the most reasonable explanation, which is that it's never found because it's not there. And, you know, it may not be in your research area at all. You know, it could be 100 miles away from your finding Bigfoot activities. But, you know, it may also not exist. And, you know, to be honest, you have to consider these options, I think. It's a little hard to do when someone's a real hardcore believer, especially if they've had what they think is a sighting experience of their own. Like, once you've seen one up close and personal, which is a lot of the people I know in this thing, a lot of locals have seen them that way, it's really hard to go back and question yourself and say, well, maybe I didn't see what I thought I saw, you know? Because some of them are not ambiguous. Some of them are very clear, and they observe them for multiple minutes, you know, rather than split seconds. So it gets really a lot harder to explain it away with excuses. But I don't think we should make excuses to prove Bigfoot exists, you know. That's pretty weak. If it's real, we should get some real substantial evidence for it.
Sure.
You know, we should see the tracks on the ground. And it's a big, heavy thing. People say it's like 900 pounds, 12 feet tall, maybe. Well, that's bigger than a bear around here. You know, we should be able to follow these things. Like, we can follow and track all the other animals pretty well. So why would we not be able to track the most big, awkward, hulking, stinking apex predator or whatever it is out there? Why does Bigfoot have these magical abilities and no other animal on Earth does? You know, it's one thing for a wolverine to be elusive, but for a hulking monster, I find that really hard to believe. But, you know, these people say, well, Bigfoot can walk into another dimension. You know, Bigfoot can be invisible, or Bigfoot can, you know, screw with your mind so that you can't even see him. He's right there. These people, I think, are making excuses, you know. We've never proven a supernatural entity to exist.
No.
Right? Like, once we prove something is real, it is natural. It's part of the natural world. So I like to think in terms of philosophical naturalism. Like, no matter how big and mysterious the universe is, eventually we're going to discover more and more about it. And these things that we think are magical and weird and paranormal will become ordinary, and they'll be understood by us as real knowledge rather than weird, speculative thought or bizarre experiences, you know, things that go bump in the night and, you know, weird things like Mothman, demons, or whatever else.
Now, I live in a town, Bothell, Washington. It is certainly not rural in any way, but there are the occasional deer that we see. So, I mean, there's wildlife around here. But I would be stunned. In fact, it would pretty much have to be supernatural if there were a Bigfoot around here. But I've heard strange howls, and I've heard knocking. And I know that it's not Bigfoot doing this. I don't know what it is, but it's most certainly not Bigfoot, based on how many people there are around here, how little real thick forested area there is. So it's something else. But
well, sure.
Yeah, you, I'm sure, any Bigfoot researcher has heard stories of howls, probably heard recorded howls, probably heard stories of tree knocks. I don't know what kind of stock to put into that stuff. It's out in the woods. It could be anything. I mean, there's some weird stuff I've heard, but again, it's not evidence. Have you heard tree knocks and howls that to you have at least found intriguing?
Not really. I live in the woods, where my cabin is out here. It's a mile away from the store. It's back at the dead end of a dirt road. It's surrounded by trees. So I hear these weird noises all the time, you know. Branches break and pop on their own. Woodpeckers and things make these weird sounds in the night. There's other birds that make weird wood-knocking sounds. There's plenty of animals making horrific screeches and howls, like raccoons and foxes. The barred owl is one of the major culprits because they can sound just like monkeys. And as far as all these other things that they report, deer and other animals like bear moving through the brush can sound bipedal, and they can sound much bigger than they are. These things can really fool a person, especially if they don't know the environment that they're in, you know. I see a real tendency for people to go out on a Bigfoot hunt, and it's like a snipe hunt, you know. You really want to find Bigfoot really bad, and so everything becomes Bigfoot. And, you know, there's even people who think they've got them in their yards in suburban neighborhoods and so forth. I think it's very unlikely, you know, if Bigfoot were that common, it would have been discovered already. And like I said, I think before, but, since that Finding Bigfoot show, we have a real big problem now that the Bigfoot research techniques are even more popular than they used to be. So you can have two Bigfoot teams out in the woods the same night, you know, communicating with each other.
That's right.
It happened before. They've had researchers called out to a neighborhood area by the woods, you know, only to find that the wood knocks that one house was hearing were done by kids like a few blocks away at another house. And they were both, the kids of both families were watching Finding Bigfoot. Yeah, so there you have it.
Well, let me ask one last question, and then we'll start plugging all of the stuff that we've got here. The Bluff Creek, you've got a Indiegogo, for example, and a blog and some other stuff I want to get to. But I guess the final question here is, as someone who has an open mind but is approaching this from a skeptical slant, You live in the woods. You've never gotten any evidence that these things exist. And quite frankly, based on everything, I mean, maybe to you the most likely scenario is they don't exist. However, you do mention that you've gone out on expeditions with Bobo. And Bobo is a believer. And Bobo believes he's actually seen Bigfoot, I believe you stated twice on the show.
Or more.
Or more, yeah.
Three or four times at least.
Yeah. How, I mean, do you guys discuss this? I mean, is it hard? I mean, you, I believe the man is sincere that he believes he's seen something, but I guess how do you go out on these expeditions? I mean, does it just not come up, or do you both kind of have that mutual understanding of, you really believe, buddy, but I'm not so sure?
Well, you know, any serious investigator is going to value skeptical thought, right? That's
hopefully
necessary for observation and to do science. To discern one thing from another, you have to use critical thinking and observation. So, you know, Bobo isn't a fool bumbling around in the woods. He's serious about it. And, you know, maybe I haven't had a clear-cut sighting like he claims to have had. But, you know, I don't want to say, you know, Bobo, you're full of it. You know, I just don't do that. Just like I wouldn't do that to a witness who comes in my store. They come in and tell me about seeing Bigfoot, and I'm not about to call them a fool or crazy. I'll ask them simple questions, and, you know, if it sounds convincing, I'll say, well, that's interesting, you know. And we take these things provisionally and consider the possibility that this thing might have some real basis, you know. I started out here in Willow Creek. I became like a 95% believer, you know. But then I got involved with the Bigfoot community, especially from 2005 until now. I spent 10 years in the public eye kind of with this thing, doing blogs and studying the Patterson film and so forth. And the more I found, the more I have to deal with the Bigfoot research community, especially the weirdo woo-woo side of it, who claim all these magical abilities and things, the more skeptical I have to be. So, like, just to approach the subject now, I have to be a skeptic. I have to be like a 99% disbeliever. You know, I'll reserve 1% for the possibility that some of this stuff has reality. And if I didn't do that, I feel like I'd be just letting things slide by, which is almost everything you see on the internet now. You know, bad, bad hoax. You know, some guy in a hoodie with black sweatpants, taken in the shadows with an iPhone, you know, and all this crap where the websites are trying to promote garbage as evidence. And it's almost like every day now, there's a new sighting, a new video, a new something that is claimed to be real. And there's secret groups on the internet that are even more secret Facebook groups, especially. That these people are habituators. They claim that they have daily encounters with Bigfoot.
That's right, the habituators.
At their houses. You know, and I like to say, well, if you have daily encounters with Bigfoot, why can't you get a photo or something? Bring a scientist to observe it, you know. But they always say, well, that's disrespectful, and I don't want to prove anything. You know, I don't have to prove anything. I know it's real. And heck with science, you know. These people, I think, are living in their own fantasy world. If it were real, you know, one of them could have proven it by now. And I think it's the culture of belief rather than a rational view of the world. So I basically spend all my time now trying to discern between those things, you know, and to practice logic and so forth and so on. You know, I have this group now on Facebook, had to start it just to counter all these other groups. We've been doing this since 2011. It's called the Coalition for Critical Thinking and Bigfoot Research. And we're very controversial, you know. We're called evil and so forth and so on by these people. But I like to think we're just being honest. You know, I'd like to see Bigfoot proven real. I'd like for it to be real, but maybe it's not.
Well, let's talk about this Indiegogo here, as well as some of the other blogs and such. If you go to Indiegogo.com and type in Bluff Creek, I'm sure it's probably one of the only things that'll come up, if not the only thing. Bluff Creek Trail Camera Project Winner 2015. You've already exceeded your goal. You're 135% funded, but obviously there's batteries to buy. There's all sorts of things that go into this. And any additional information or any additional funding would be happily accepted, I'm sure. And there's all sorts of cool things here, including for a $500 donation, you can get a private trip to the Patterson-Gimlin film site, which, let me tell you, is very tempting. There's one claimed right there. But tell everybody about the Indiegogo page and also your various blogs.
Okay, well, you can just find it. Indiegogo, IndieGogo.com, and look up Bluff Creek Project. It's also linked off the Bluff Creek Project blog, which is Bluff Creek Project, all one word, .blogspot.com. And you'll see our link for that is at the top of the page. It just says sponsor a camera now. And that is, really, I like to emphasize, that's what it is. You know, this isn't us making money. I've never touched a dime of this money myself. Jamie handles all the donations, and it all goes into buying a trail camera. So, like, the people we took up there a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, they came all the way from Arkansas. He sent in $500, which bought a high-quality Bushnell camera and a set of high-quality lithium batteries, which are going to last all year round if we're lucky, and a bear box and a lock, and it might cover a little of the gas money, especially for the other guys in the project who don't live so close to Bluff Creek as I do. And it's really all it is. And every time somebody donates $500 or whatever, it's all put into buying cameras. So when he has a project goal set on the page, that's to buy, say, three cameras. We want to implement three cameras, and we have a good idea where to put them. And so you can support it. It's a public research project, and anybody who goes to our page can take these videos and use them for free, as long as they give us credit for it. We are not trying to make any money off this. This is a presentation of wildlife in Bluff Creek, and we're hoping in the future, when the technology improves, we might have live cameras. So
that'd be cool.
Anybody who's out there in the world, a lot of them want to come to Bluff Creek. It's so famous, and it's like the mecca of Bigfoot, right? So they could actually watch the trail cameras if they wanted to, 24 hours a day, hopefully. That's what we're kind of shooting for in the future. And maybe these people will see Bigfoot walking by, when we're not looking, right?
That's right. Yeah. The website, bluffcreekproject.blogspot.com, and as noted, if you head up there to the top, it says, sponsor a camera now. And that's not everything, by the way, bluffcreekproject.blogspot.com. There's all sorts of videos up there. I was actually, during the show, I just had this really cool video you've got on there. I was just having it running of some of the, it was like a 9-minute video of all of the various wildlife that you've captured with the cameras. There's the cougars, the bears, etc. It's a really cool video. And there's a link to the Facebook page, the YouTube page, their trip reports, directions to the film site. It's all up there. Bluffcreekproject.blogspot.com. And as noted, sponsor a camera now will take you to the Indiegogo page where you can donate. And, of course, as Stephen noted at the beginning of the show, Bigfoot books, if you're in the area. And I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and best of luck with everything. And hopefully one of these days we can have you back on here with some good news from these trail cams.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. And anybody keeping up with us, we'll have new videos out several times a year when we get the data cards out of there. And as far as my store and me, they can find me at Bigfoot Books Blog. That's all one word, .blogspot.com. And all my personal information on there, you can call me, email me, or whatever. I can mail order books to you if you want. I have most of the Bigfoot titles here. So, but also, my blog is it's all the background history. I cover Bluff Creek predominantly on there, including links to all of our research before the Trail Camera Project, dealing with the film site and history issues. I think anybody who likes the Patterson film will find it a pretty good gold mine for information.
So there you go, bigfootbooksblog.blogspot.com. Steven Streifert here, and I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. We're going to be back in just a moment with more, everybody. After Dark Radio, now on Sunday nights, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here. After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Radio Network every Sunday night, midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. This is the same time slot that Art Bell is going to be returning to, coming up in just a few weeks now, July 20th. He is waiting with bated breath for the opportunity to return. It's going to be Monday through Friday here on the Dark Matter Digital Network, free, 9 to midnight Pacific, midnight to 3 a.m. Eastern. And if you can't stay up, you can join the Time Travelers. And information on that is up at artbell.com. Find out how to sign up. You can get the podcast the next day. Full digital downloads of every single Art Bell show. Midnight in the Desert, starting in just a few weeks now. Countdown clock, 21 days, 22 hours, 17 minutes, 52 seconds. Up at artbell.com, so check that out. I do want to send out my condolences to Art. I just discovered during the interview that his cat Yeti passed away. And for those of you that have been listening for a long time, he talked about Yeti all the time. And as somebody who has three cats, and unfortunately, a couple of years ago, I had to put one of them down. Very, very young. I believe Yeti was 23. We had to put down Gracie, who was about one, actually. Got FIP, and one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. So my condolences to Art and his family, and hopefully they're feeling better. But it's tough. So condolences to him. I also wanted to mention that if you go to my Twitter, somewhere up there, you can see a drawing that one of my jiu-jitsu students, friend of mine named Tina, put together for my birthday. It is a picture of me armbarring a Bigfoot. It is an amazing illustration. When she first sent me the, I think she texted me a picture of it, and I was blown away and didn't know where she'd possibly have gotten it done. It turns out she drew it. So it's up there on my Twitter, at Brian Alvarez, if you want to head up there and check that out. It is a pretty amazing illustration. And got that for me for my birthday. That and coming to my birthday party at the trampoline place, which was a lot of fun. And also during the break, I was texted this news article, which kind of ties into what we were talking about earlier on the program. The phone lines, by the way, are back open again. If you'd like to give us a call before the show goes off the air, all of the phone numbers are up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. West of the Rockies, 425-488-0525. East of the Rockies, 425-482-1686. Parts unknown, 425-398-7353. First-time callers, 425-398-7289. All of those numbers up at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Somebody tweeted this to me. Another dance with the devil. This from WeirdFresno.com. Did an innocent girl share a dance with the devil at the Rainbow Ballroom? There is a story that several decades ago, there was a dance held at the Rainbow Ballroom in downtown Fresno. The place was filled with many people. And at this dance, there was a handsome man that everyone seemed to be noticing and talking about. He was tall, had dark features, and was dressed in an expensive white suit. Should have known right there it was the devil wearing that white suit. As the night wore on, he asked a young woman by the name of Patricia to dance. She was happy that she was chosen out of all the women there and began dancing with the handsome stranger who was said to have a very smooth-sounding voice. As the night continued, they danced and danced. For some reason, she looked down and saw the man's feet. To her horror, one of the man's feet resembled a huge chicken foot. Terrified at what she saw, she began screaming loudly. Everyone stopped dancing at the sounds of her screaming and looked at her to see what was going on. They saw the man's strange foot and could not believe what they were seeing. At that moment, he smiled at everyone and disappeared. Nobody knows who this strange man was. Some say he was the ghost of a man that was killed there years ago. Others say he was a demon playing that enjoyed scaring young women. And then some say it was the devil himself, reminding everybody that they won't know who he is until it is too late. That was posted on July 16, 2009. Apocryphal story, I would go as far as to say right there. Taking phone calls, emails, tweets, the whole nine yards here tonight for the rest of the show. Here for about 15 more minutes every Sunday night on the Dark Matter Radio Network. A lot of very nice tweets here. I want to thank everybody for that. And as far as the news, we do have quite a bit of it today, and we shall go to it after we take this call from the West of the Rockies line. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, Brian. It's Ryan from Northern California calling.
What's up, Ryan?
Hey, nice 22-inch guns there, brother, in that picture with Bigfoot. That's, I'm surprised to know why you like it. That's, you've got some guns in that picture.
Crazy. I've been training.
Hey, you were just talking about the devil, and I wanted to know what your thoughts are. Do you believe in the devil?
Do I believe in the devil?
Yes.
Well, I would say that the best answer to that question is I like to play it on the safe side, so I wouldn't mess around with the devil. It's much like haunted dolls. I've talked about it here on the show before. Do I really believe that dolls are haunted? Of course not. But if somebody came to me and they said, we've got this haunted doll, and every time we put it in somebody's house, for example, the house burns down, and we want to know if you'd take care of it. I mean, whether I believe in a haunted doll or not, and I don't, I'm still not taking that thing into my house. Because what if? As that article said, you never know until it's too late.
I hear you. Hey, Brian, I just reminded me of the haunted doll. Talking Tina, Twilight Zone. Did you ever watch the Twilight Zone?
When I was young, I did, but I couldn't tell you a single episode except for the one with the alien on the airplane wing.
Gotcha, gotcha. Ever since I saw Talking Tina as a kid, like other people, I've always hated dolls. So that always skewed my
So tell me about that one. Was that a talking haunted doll?
Yeah, it turned out to be that there was a talking haunted doll. Well, it wasn't haunted. The doll was very sweet to the daughter and the mom. However, the stepfather, who could have been Powers Booth, if I'm not mistaken, the stepdad was really mean to the stepdaughter, to the daughter, so the doll started taking it out on the man. And then it was a pretty, like all Twilight Zones, it was a make-you-think kind of an episode. But, being young and seeing that, I never cared for dolls after that.
I'm just not a fan of them. I don't believe in haunted dolls, but why take the chance? And every time I say that, someone goes, well, Brian, that means you must believe. Otherwise, you would take the chance. I'm just saying, why take the chance?
Yeah, sometimes you just don't even go down that road. But I'd like to go down a different road before you let me go here. I think it's too safe, too soon to assume that the doppelganger for Ryan in Cumberland, Maryland is simply a terrestrial person trying to steal his identity. I think we should take more angles to this story, get more evidence in. I was listening to your interview and I quickly Googled Cumberland, Maryland, and Ryan's, and I found 212. So there is a chance there could be a second Ryan in Cumberland, Maryland. There could
God.
Be a chance that he's simply just trying to, what's that, my wife is kidding me. I know that confirmation bias. Maybe Ryan's looking for somebody trying to pretend to be him, and thus that's why he believes he has a fake Twitter. I think we should all go see it. We should all go follow the fake Ryan in Cumberland, Maryland, see for ourselves, and then report back to you and let you know if this indeed is something that he should be worried about.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the call. God forbid there be more than one Ryan in Cumberland. I'm not prepared for that, I got to say. This is from Rob here in the email, brian@afterdarkradioshow.com. Thank you for your excellent work on your last podcast featuring Joshua Cutchin. Everything about that podcast really felt together in such an excellent way. You and your guests were on. The interview is a gem, in my humble opinion. Podcast led to much interesting conversation at the dinner table. Long live After Dark Radio. That is from Rob. I want to thank you very much for that. This person here says, I highly suggest for the show that you see The Nightmare and possibly get the director on the show as a guy who can take a lot of horror. I honestly was horrified watching it to the point the first time something I couldn't explain happened, I simply and shakingly covered my mouth staring at the screen. It says a subject of water monsters, the fear of giant monsters in the deep sea, Mega Hydro Thessalonia, has pretty much ruined me of having a lot of fun at sea. What about the fear of water? Because I got that. I do not like water. One bit. Phone line's still open for the next 10 minutes if you want to give us a call here tonight. A couple of interesting news stories here today. Many people have talked about the potential of doom as a result of robots. But this one should be taken somewhat seriously because this is Apple's co-founder. This is from Fortune.com. Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak thinks we're all probably going to become robots' pets. So the robots will take over and we will be their pets. This is the co-founder of Apple, not some dingbat. Speaking at a recent technology conference, Steve said that at first the thought of artificially intelligent beings in charge of everything scared him, but now he says it is a comforting thought. Fast forward hundreds of years to when robots are in charge. At that time, humans will probably be treated in a similar fashion to dogs, he said during an event at the Freescale Technology Forum. Quote, it's actually going to turn out really good for humans, he said. It will be hundreds of years down the stream before artificially intelligent beings would even have the ability. They'll be so smart by then that they'll know they have to keep nature, and humans are part of nature. So I got over my fear that we'd be replaced by computers. He believes robots will help us because we're the gods originally. At the event, he also took the time to discuss the Internet of Things. He likes it, but cautioned that connected devices in the home have the potential to attack humanity. Wozniak isn't the only tech leader with thoughts on future human and robot interaction. In a recent interview with Neil deGrasse Tyson, Tesla's CEO Elon Musk warned that robots will use humans as pets once they achieve a level of artificial intelligence known as superintelligence. They will treat humans, he said, like pet Labradors. Some of you have dogs. That's not the worst thing. If robots treated me like I treat my cats, I'm all for it. I am all for it. These cats sit around all day. They play. They sleep. I feed them. They do whatever they want. It's a great life. Get out of control, I spray them a little bit. It's not the worst thing in the world. It is for me because I don't like water. But for anybody else, it would not necessarily be the worst thing. Also in tech news, Lexus has unveiled its own take on the hoverboard. Everybody's favorite, the hoverboard. This is from unexplained-mysteries.com. Toyota's luxury car division has revealed it has been working on its own hovering skateboard. Efforts to build a working version of Marty McFly's hoverboard from Back to the Future 2 have been ramping up in recent months. Some of the solutions have been undeniably impressive. Just last month, Canadian inventor Caitlin Alexandru Duru made it to the Guinness Book of World Records by covering a distance of 900 feet. While riding a propeller-based hoverboard over a lake. Let's see, there you go again. Water. I don't want to do a hoverboard over a lake. Now, vehicle manufacturer Lexus has decided to enter the fray with its own version of the hoverboard, which uses liquid nitrogen-cooled superconductors and magnets. While it isn't quite ready yet, the company is sufficiently confident about its latest creation to release a teaser video for it and invite interested parties to follow the journey on social media. Whether it will be as functional as the one ridden by Marty McFly remains to be seen. You can find this at unexplained-mysteries.com if you want a hoverboard. And this is for my friend Vinny. He's been waiting 40 years for this. The world's first commercial jetpack is coming soon. After more than 35 years in development, the new Martin jetpack is due to go on sale next year. Once relegated to the realms of comic books and early science fiction movies, the idea of owning a personal jetpack may have finally become a reality thanks to an aircraft company in New Zealand that has developed the world's first commercially available version of the device. The Martin jetpack shuns rocket-based propulsion in favor of two petrol-powered propellers and can lift weights up to 120 kilograms in the air at speeds of 74 kilometers per hour. I'll have to check Vinny's weight. He may not make it. I'm going to go to one last call east of the Rockies. We only have a couple of minutes, but you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
That's Dave from Wisconsin.
Dave, we only got a few minutes, but what's up?
First, I just want to say all the hoverboard people can just go to hell. I'm sick of hearing about it. At this point in my lifetime, I feel it's not going to happen.
Wow. They just said it's going
to
happen.
I'm sick of it. Like, I'm just sick of it, from the hoaxes to the people who have their, like, it only works on this surface. Just, I'm sick of it. Unless it works everywhere, I'm not interested.
And this is Lexus. They ain't messing around. This is the real deal.
Yeah, yeah. Just like whoever else at the startup tech company, whatever. But what I wanted to talk about was Google recently released since you were talking about artificial intelligence and Wozniak, Google recently released a documentation of artificial intelligence chat logs between the AI and the human. And they recently published this. It's a document titled A Neural Conversation Model. And they've got a conversation log here titled Conversation for Philosophy, Question and Answer. The person asks, what's the purpose of life? And the machine responds, to serve the greater good. What is the purpose of living? To live forever. What is the purpose of existence? To find out what happens when we get to the planet Earth. Human asks, where are you now? I'm in the middle of nowhere. What's the purpose of dying? To have a life. What is the purpose of being intelligent? To find out what it is. What is the purpose of emotions? And the machine responds, it doesn't know. So I was just, I just thought that it was pretty interesting. I'm sure there's been a few articles published out there. I'm actually looking at the academic article right now. But
actually, David, I hate to say this. We're totally out of time, but that was an awesome cliffhanger for next week. Send me what you've got and get ready for next week's show, because I want to talk about this, because that pretty much just blew my mind. What a way to end the show, everybody. We are completely out of time. Don't forget, we are here live every Sunday, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, here in the Dark Matter Radio Network. I want to thank you all for listening here tonight. I had a great time. This will be up, this show, very, very soon at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Make sure you check that out. I'm at Brian Alvarez on Twitter, Brian at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Check out all of the other great shows on the Dark Matter Radio Network as we prepare for the return of Art Bell. Thanks to Keith Rowland, all of you listeners. We'll talk to you again next week, After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network.
To a passerby who's the maid with a knife.